Blog Talk Radio.
He is the last of his kind. All that remains of a once powerful nation. Some think he is a myth. Some believe he is the chosen one who will bring balance to a world at war. And some will stop at nothing to destroy him.
Welcome, Morris and Morris Talk Live 100. I'm your host, Tahaka Amana L. Bay. And tonight we got some very, very interesting information for you. And let me start off by saying that for those of you who are on your social sites, Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, MySpace, and so on and so forth, go ahead and send me your friend request, and I'll grant that. And that'll give you access to my wall where we post all the preliminary for my shows and the free articles and stuff for very, very interesting information where you can get a head start on a lot that's going on inside the United States. Tonight we're going to be dealing with the true ancient civilizations of Europe and the Americas. And as soon as I get a switchboard, we're going to be ready to go. We've been having some technical difficulties here, the likes of which I've never seen. However, we're offering our free articles this evening, the 14th Amendment Exposed, as well as the Commerce Game and How to Play and Secrets of America. And the way to access that, just send me an email. They talk and send me the free articles you mentioned on your broadcast to tahaka53@hotmail.com, and I'll get that right on to you. Also, what we're going to be dealing with this evening is coming straight out of Tahaka's archives, and all of this information is already there, and what we have done is gathered it up and put it in a different nutshell for you, so you can look at this thing from a whole different perspective and make an intelligent decision. No intelligent person would make a decision without having all the facts. So what we're going to do is be as factual as we possibly can and bring you as much information as we can on the following subjects. Now, who are the original people that built the pyramids in America? I mean, we hear a whole lot about, well, the Egyptians built the pyramids, and they built the pyramids, and the Egyptians done that. What color were they? When you going to get to it? Were the Moors slaves in Europe? Let's find out. Who are the Indians? Because if we got Indians in America and all nationalities associated with a landmass, then we got Indians in India associated with a landmass called India, then we got to go back and re-examine who's been labeled as Indians in this country that didn't come from India. Let's get this stuff clearly understood and pull the wool off of this stuff, dig up every rock, look in every nook and cranny, and pull it all out, and let's get some answers from the people who placed these labels there. Perhaps they can tell us and explain it all to us. But let's make sure that nothing gets technical or politically correct Let's make sure they just give us the raw, naked facts. And this is what we're trying to get to today. And so you all sit tight. My position on the whole nut and kit and caboodle is based on 20 years of research from some of the most prolific writers in history whose credibility is world-renowned. Replacing the label white with the species called Caucasian. Should we do that? Were Caucasians ever made slaves? We'll try to deal with that. Where did Christianity come from? Where did the Christian church come from? Who does the Pope worship? Let's deal with some of that kind of stuff there today, this evening, and see where we can see what we can do with some of that, okay? And still working on getting this switchboard. I don't think they want me to talk about this in the night. It seems like they, man, we don't want you saying this kind of stuff here, because you be coming out with all the facts where everybody can see it. And no holds barred. There ain't no doubt about it when you get through. So, nevertheless, we're up and running now. My position is, once again, I have to go on what I see and what I've investigated and the facts. Okay? There's certain things that I have found inside the Bible that's only found there. And for years and years and years, nothing else coming from nowhere else. No verification, no evidence, no nothing. And then we got this big, fat, crooked situation going on over in the Middle East. And we got, I heard a gentleman who was calling himself an Egyptian, who was not African, that said that what we was witnessing had nothing to do with whether or not the people was black. It is very, very extraordinary and amazing to me to see these kind of things going on and people saying the stuff they do. But what I do is just go ahead and bring the facts to the table. So what we're going to do is we're going to put some stuff down. But the first thing we're going to do, the very first thing, is let's determine whether or not Caucasians was ever made slaves. So y'all sit back and hold your hat.
Okay, let's get to our guest tonight. Our guest tonight is a gentleman by the name of Michael A. Hoffman. He is the author of a recent history book entitled They Were White and They Were Slaves. It's the untold story of the enslavement of white people in early America. Mr. Hoffman was educated at Oswego State Teachers College and Hobart College. He is a former reporter for the Albany and Buffalo, New York bureaus of the Associated Press and a former director of the Institute for Historical Review. He is the author of three other books, by the way, and has published also a bi-monthly history newsletter entitled Revisionist Researcher. And Mr. Hoffman, are you with us tonight?
Yes, I am.
Appreciate you being with us tonight. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, I can.
Good. Well, you've done a magnificent work on a book that, as I don't have to tell you, is not politically correct.
That's right. It isn't at all.
How's it being received out there?
Well, it's being received as sort of a samizdat publication. People are ordering it through bookstores, and there's a growing audience for it. We've sold several thousand copies, and I think that the more publicity that it gets, eventually the audience will grow nationwide and worldwide, God willing.
Well, let's start talking about it. I got some questions to ask you. Now, we've been told that black people have been enslaved and oppressed in America for 400 years, and that the American people need to make reparations to blacks Perhaps sometimes it suggested cash payments. And as a result, they're saying of this black enslavement, that's the least we can do. Now, you've written a book claiming that it was the white people who were actually the first slaves in America. So who owes who, Mr. Hoffman?
Well, white people don't owe anyone, Pastor Peters. The fact of the matter is that white youth today are taught that black slaves and Mexicans and Chinese built this country, while the vast majority of the whites lorded it over them with a whiplash in one hand, you know, and a mint julep in the other. But the documentary record tells a very different story. Up to one half of all the arrivals in the American colonies were white slaves, and they were America's first slaves. These whites were slaves for life long before blacks ever were. And this white slavery was even hereditary. White children were born to white slaves, and they were also enslaved. Whites were auctioned on a block, with children sold and separated from their parents. Wives were sold and separated from their husbands. Meanwhile, you had free black property owners walking the streets of northern and south southern American cities, while white slaves are being worked to death in the sugar mills of Barbados and Jamaica in the West Indies and in the tobacco plantations of Virginia. So the establishment has created this misnomer of indentured servitude to explain away and minimize the fact of white slavery. But if you really read even the establishment historians, if you read their footnotes, even they have to concede, at the very least in the 17th century, that black slavery was almost non-existent and that whites were the overwhelming majority of slaves in America in the 17th century.
Where does the word slave itself come from? Isn't it exclusively in reference to the experience of black people in bondage?
No, it isn't, Pastor Peters. Actually, the word slave derives from the white nation of people known as the Slavs, or the Slavic people. And they were enslaved longer than the entire history of the United States. The Slavic people were slaves about twice as long as blacks were slaves in North America. So the actual definition of that word pertains to the experience of white people in bondage. Yet the politically correct historians tell us that we're not allowed to refer to whites as slaves. So it's really a huckster's game that's at work there.
It's that old wordsmith game, isn't it?
That's correct.
How did the enslavement of whites in America begin, anyway?
Well, the enslavement of whites in America really actually has its roots in Great Britain, because it's really a very complex story. Of course, the history of whites in bondage goes all the way back to the ancient world. The ancient Greeks and the ancient Romans, of course, held slaves, and the majority of those slaves were white. This has pretty much been the essential experience of all people throughout time, and it's ludicrous to say that it's exclusively the experience of blacks. However, if we bring this up to the American colonial period, we must go to Britain, because, of course, America was a colony of Britain. And Britain began its decline in the 16th century, shortly after the reign of Henry VIII. It really, I would say, it went into decline under his son, the very weak boy king, Edward VI. And in the era of Edward VI, we see that usury, or the charging of interest on loans, that had been illegal in Britain. And during the reign of Edward VI, he was being manipulated by his counselors, and that's when usury was legalized in Britain in 1548. And from that point onward, you also had the beginnings of the enclosure laws, which was the taking away of the right of the English people to farm freely in these common lands which had existed. They were basically swindled out of their land. And from that, you had a pauperization process beginning. You had the first real beginnings of a class of white people in Great Britain known as paupers. And once you had that, of course, you had all the social evils that came along with the paupers. Now, pauperization began in a large scale way under Queen Elizabeth I, and this is when you had the first welfare laws in Britain being passed. And when white people who had formerly been yeomen, who had been freemen, now there had been a class of white slaves in early Britain known as the villains, from which we get the disparaging term of villain. It was spelled a little bit differently with an E on the end instead of an A. However, you still had a majority of the whites able to farm and able to live as free men. Now, more and more, the majority of whites were changing over from free men and yeomen and landholders and farmers over to this class, this formal class of paupers. And that's what began the roots of white slavery, because once you had paupers, you had developing the workhouse system, which was the way to manage the paupers, which was to enslave them in an institution where they could be controlled, which was the workhouse system in Great Britain.
That's an amazing story. In fact, it's so amazing that I know there are some people, just using the understanding cognitive dissonance, that they're rejecting some of the things you're saying because it seems so fantastic that they've never heard this. What happened to whites in Great Britain if they opposed the king or they were defeated in battle? You know, in high school today and in colleges, we're told that the whites have been so-called indentured servants, that we do hear about some of indentured servants in America, but never slaves. And I know you address it in the book, and I want you to tell the people about it.
Right. Well, first of all, of course, you had battle captives and people who were opposing the king, or if they lost in battle in the various civil wars and rebellions in Great Britain, generally, one of their punishments, if they were fortunate enough to escape execution, was enslavement. And what would happen to them is they would be transported. That was a technical term. It didn't just mean that you were put on a ship, but it was actually a term related to forced deportation from Great Britain. And these various white rebels against the crown were then transported to the British Crown colonies of the West Indies, particularly Barbados and Jamaica, where they were basically worked to death in the sugar mills there. And when white tourists go to Jamaica and Barbados, they're basically going to the scene of a white Holocaust, because most of these white men didn't survive beyond the first couple of years there. However, this enslavement was long-term. It just did not involve only political prisoners or those who had lost battles, but it also involved the kidnapping, as I will discuss later, of whites off the streets of Great Britain, so that even in the early parts of the 20th century, you had a remnant of poor whites in Barbados known as the Red Shanks, who were the survivors of white slavery there. So it was a very onerous thing to be captured in battle, and you were, in fact, subject to slavery as a result.
The Red Shanks, would that anyway tie up with the word rednecks?
Absolutely, yes.
Is that right?
Yes, this is one of the racist terms which the media freely uses. We're often told that the most horrible word, I think this specter was summoned in the O.J. Simpson circus, that the most horrible word in the English language, one of his lawyers said, was the N-word. However, to conscious white people, one of the most horrible words is the word redneck. And this term of derision is bandied about in movies and television and in the newspapers totally blithely. We're just supposed to take this. We're supposed to be labeled in this way. However, if we look at the etymology of the word, the root of it is a means of poking fun at poor white people whose skin would redden in the sun in the West Indies, and they would be called hillbillies, Scotland Johnnies, by blacks and by wealthy whites who enslaved them, Red Shanks, and eventually this term of derision, this loathsome, contemptible term for poor white people, eventually evolved into the modern-day term of redneck, yes.
That's fascinating. How were the slaves actually enslaved? How were the whites enslaved if they were not just indentured servants?
Well, the indentured servant thing was basically a racket. I mean, there was a minority of people who were in bondage who were fortunate enough to have been indentured servants, because after all, indentured servitude, when it is practiced correctly and legally, is a form of apprenticeship. Someone, as we were told in high school and college, would grade a period of his labor in return for passage over on a boat or in return for instruction in a skilled trade. So that is a legitimate a contract there between a laborer and an employer, and I certainly sanction it. I think it's a good thing. In fact, I'd like to see apprenticeship practiced more today as more and more young people get away from the public school systems and they're homeschooled by their parents, and then as they reach their teens, why, it would be quite natural for them to apprentice themselves to a manager or someone who had something to teach them. However, under this euphemism of indentured servitude, Pastor Peters, a tremendous hoax and a tremendous swindle was perpetrated against the poor white people. And that is to say, it functioned in two ways. One, as a cover-up for the actual experience of white people in slavery. In other words, as this slavery grew larger and larger, and the white aristocracy in Britain scrambled for a way to cover it up, they grouped it under the notion of a contract for indenture. Secondly, it functioned as a way of entrapping people. In other words, people would be press-ganged or kidnapped aboard ships, and a spurious indenture would be written out for them, allegedly corresponding to the biblical injunction that no servitude is to go beyond a period of 7 years, and this is where we get the notion of a seven-year limit. In fact, that limit was completely ignored, and these people were referred to as indentured servants. They were even told that they had a contract of indenture, but in fact, they were slaves for life. Now, the way this occurred, the real engine of this enslavement in Britain was kidnapping. And again, if we go to our study of words, we find out that the origin of the word kidnapping, which is now a universal term for anyone who steals people, relates to white slavery. If you go to the old dictionaries, you'll find out that the original word was kidnabbing, N-A-B-B-I-N-G. And it's a specific reference to stealing white children and white adults for servitude in colonial America. And tens of thousands of them were kidnapped from the port cities of England and Scotland. In fact, it got so bad in the late 17th century that parents were in great fear to let their children go to the port cities on an errand without their parents or some other adult guardian safeguarding them. And in fact, even if an adult was along, oftentimes that adult would be knocked on the head and put on board the ship. And in my book, They Were White and They Were Slaves, I give many accounts of this mass kidnapping in action. So that was the principal means by which whites were brought to America as slaves. A secondary means was to trick them into the idea that they were going to have a limited contract of indenture for 7 years. But then when they came to America, you see, there was a way to lengthen that 7 years and to violate the biblical injunction against servitude going beyond 7 years. The way that happened was to create a roster of petty offenses. For example, if a white slave was away from his work or away from the plantation for more than a day or even for more than an hour, if the overseer decided that this was an arbitrary absence, they would add on a month of servitude to the white slave's time of service. And through various stratagems and tricks, this adding on went to the point where the people ended up being enslaved for life. And that's the real reality of bondage of whites in America. It's white slavery and not largely indentured servitude.
It's an amazing story, and ladies and gentlemen, this amazing story is told in Mr. Hoffman's book, They Were White and They Were Slaves, The Untold History of the Enslavement of Whites in Early America. Truth of the matter is, whites were the first slaves in America, not blacks. And that the media is not telling you. We're carrying this book, and of course I'm offering it on this shortwave broadcast. And if you would like to have this book, They Were White and They Were Slaves, it's available for a
$16 offering postpaid.
Write to Scriptures for America, P.O. Box 766, LaPorte, Colorado, 80535. That's Scriptures for America, P.O. Box 766, LaPorte, Colorado, 80535. Mr. Hoffman, are you a Christian?
Yes, I am.
Let's go back to the book. Were there white children who were made slaves? How about white women also?
Yes, very definitely. If you were born to a white woman, then you also became the property of the owner. Now, for a white woman was basically banned. A white slave woman could not be married. And, of course, the slave masters realized that these women were going to exercise this function of nature, that it would be unnatural for them to suppress their procreative urge. And there were secret marriages, of course, by the score between white slave males and white slave females, but this played right into the hands of their owners, because then more time was added on to their allegedly limited service by the fact that she had these children out of wedlock. Then the children became the property of the master. Now, it depended on which era of colonial law this occurred in. The law became more liberal in the early 18th century. A child born to a white woman who was enslaved would be the slave of the master if it was a female until she was 18, if it was a male until he was 21. However, in the 17th century, when things were much rougher, their enslavement could go as long as until the age of 31. So this was really dependent on the local situation in the various states. It dates back to an old Roman slave code, which decreed partus sequitur ventrum, the condition of the child follows the condition of the mother. So you see, this was really a slave law, which we've seen all these heart-rendering Hollywood movies and on Ted Turner's TNT channel and so forth, but what they never tell us is this was first the experience of white people in bondage, and only later the experience of some black people in bondage. So yes, white families suffered tremendously under white slavery in colonial America, you bet.
You're not saying that there weren't black families later on that also suffered, are you?
No, of course not. I regard the enslavement of blacks as a terrible tragedy for black people, but a worse tragedy for whites, primarily because this country, the Civil War, I think, was partly fought because there were white men in the North who abhorred the idea of using Negro labor to build the country. Congressman David Wilmot was a great Northern congressman who sponsored the Wilmot Proviso, and that said that that white men should be the ones who settle the West, because the issue of the South being kind of the white nationalists on the side of the white people, and the Northerners all being race mixers on the side of the blacks, is really not an accurate dichotomy there. It was far more complex than that, and one of the issues was whether or not the Southern holders of black slaves were going to be allowed to import thousands of blacks into California and Oregon. And a lot of white working men didn't want this to happen, including Congressman David Wilmot. And so basically their attitude towards black enslavement was that it was a curse on America, because white men wanted to be separatists. They wanted a separate nation, an all-white nation, and they wanted to do the toil. Now, in fact, they had done the toil, because the founding toil of this nation, the great land clearing and swamp clearing, the felling of the trees, was largely done by white pioneers. So that work had been done, but as the financial oligarchy in the South continued to depend on black enslavement, this really troubled the white yeomanry of the United States. So it was a tragedy for both, but I think especially a tragedy for white people. And, of course, the most far-sighted of American statesmen founded in 1830 the American Colonization Society for the deportation of blacks back to Africa. And many black people supported this, and in fact, as you know, Pastor Peters, many blacks continue to support that to this day.
Yes, in fact, I had a black speaker at one of my past Christian family Bible camps, Mr. Brock. I don't know if you've heard of him or not.
Yes, I have.
And he's certainly an advocate of it.
Right.
So what you're saying then, Michael, is that virtually every component of what we've come to know as black slavery was first experienced by whites when they were enslaved here in America.
Absolutely. That's absolutely correct. From the fugitive slave law, where whites had a price on their head and were hunted and nearly whipped to death, and in some cases the whippings were actually fatal, to the auctioning of white slaves. As soon as they came off ships, they were taken like cattle, and their arms were felt, and their teeth were examined, and so forth. And this has been tremendously suppressed. And people can say, well, you know, if this actually happened, why haven't I heard about it? Well, for those of us who are a little bit sophisticated about history, we know that history is rigged and that many historians owe their jobs to how well they play with the party line. But there's also another aspect at work here, and that is the fact that in the late 18th century and throughout the 19th century and even in the early 20th century, because this bondage extends right up into the 20th century, white people were very ashamed if they had a background of servitude. Many of those whites ended up settling in Appalachia. They became very alienated from the mainstream of the United States, and they were ashamed of their background. There was no one to come along and champion their cause here. They saw it as a kind of a stigma. Secondly, the aristocracy that had perpetrated this Holocaust against their own kin realized that they committed a great crime, both in the eyes of sacred scripture and in the eyes of common law. And so it was in their interest to cover this up as much as possible. So it's mostly fallen to me to be the one to dig this back up again and bring it to the attention of all people, black and white, so that we can deal with it and so that other researchers and historians can further explore it, because it's a pioneering field and there's a lot of room here for further discussion and investigation.
Where did you start going to find this material? Of course, you've got an excellent bibliography in the back, so I shouldn't ask you that, but why don't you tell the people?
Well, I live here in upstate New York, and believe it or not, New York is not entirely comprised of Manhattan. In fact, we have tried to break off the state. We've tried to make Manhattan the 51st state and make upstate New York, which is largely rural and farms, its own republic. So I'm in a very rural area, and the history here is very rich. Revolutionary War battles were fought, especially the Indian Wars of the American Revolution, with Generals Clinton and Sullivan fighting the Iroquois. And also, I'm quite near to New England. In fact, when I originally became interested in this story, it was by researching Matthew Lyon, who is one of the American Revolutionary War heroes. He was a hero of the Battle of Bennington, Vermont. The famous commander of that, of course, was Ethan Allen. But as I began to dig into Matthew Lyon's story, I discovered that Matthew Lyon was a white slave. He became a very great American politician and a congressman, and in fact, he was imprisoned in a famous sedition case after the Americans won their freedom. He was imprisoned by the Federalists, but he became a great and accomplished man. He wrote a book, and he referred himself to himself as, "By the bulls that redeem me." Apparently, Matthew Lyon had been sold in return for a couple of male deer. And, I mean, that was the status of white people in the 18th century in America. And so I couldn't find his grave, and later on I found out that he wasn't buried in New England at all, but he went down much later in his career after his wife died to the Kentucky-Tennessee area, where he made a name for himself in business. I did locate the grave of his wife. But as I discovered this, I was quite shocked that here was a great Revolutionary War hero whose life as a young man, he was an immigrant from Ireland, was worth no more than two male stags. And from there, I began digging into diaries and documents and early colonial laws and piecing this together. And I also found that historians in their published works have parts of the story, but they're basically too pusillanimous to refer to it for what it is. There's a real problem among historians. They refuse to refer to whites as slaves. It's almost a phobia on their part. You can trace a great deal of their research leading inevitably, pointing in the direction of the fact that whites were slaves, but for reasons of political correctness, they can't bring themselves to use that word. So the footsteps and the tracks of this great mystery can be ferreted out in a number of areas, both in terms of original research, diaries, and letters, as well as in published history.
During the Civil War, let me ask you this, or the War Between the States, as they call it, the Northern abolitionists accused the Southern whites of being heartless. But the Confederates, they would counter by claiming that the Northern whites held white people in virtual slavery in the factories in the North. What can you tell my audience about the enslavement of white factory workers in America, and in Britain, for that matter?
Yes, well, Pastor Peters, that's another suppressed story. It was one of the really great challenges of the Southerners against the North and has gone largely unanswered. The factory system, once again, began in Great Britain during the Industrial Revolution, and it itself was a form of enslavement. Now, we might feel to say, well, the popular image of slavery is on a plantation, and we may be willing to grant the idea that whites were enslaved on tobacco plantations, but how can you say whites were slaved in a factory? Well, it's very easy because the documentary record shows that they were locked into the factory. The doors were locked. These were largely, by the way, children who were workers in the factories that did the very toughest of the work, both in the northern United States as well as in industrial Britain. They worked under the absolutely most horrendous conditions.
What age of children are we talking about?
We're talking from an age, depending on the machinery and the type of work, we're talking from as young as 5 years old on up to 14 or 15. So you had that situation where these northern abolitionists, many of them were factory owners. As we know, Frederick Engels was a factory owner, but he claimed to have a tremendous interest in the welfare of poor whites. This seems to be a functional act of hypocrisy on the part of the socialists. William Morris, the arts and crafts socialist in Great Britain, was a strong proponent of this egalitarian society and wanted to use a central government in order to inflict this socialism. Yet if you look at his actual personal life, you discover that he made a fortune off white child labor in the Devon Consols copper mine in Great Britain. So this hypocrisy certainly functioned among the northern abolitionists in the great mill towns such as Lowell, Massachusetts. The white people were severely injured in the machinery. I have cases where girls would get their hair caught in the machinery, and they would be scalped from the tops of their nose to the back of their heads. As soon as these white children experienced this kind of disability, they were let go. They were fired on the spot. There was no disability insurance or payments or anything like that, and they were left to die of their wounds. So there were no Harriet Beecher Stowe's that had any concern about these white children in the North who were dying in that very horrendous way.
You give an account in your book of a scene in the British Parliament during the time when the British were abolishing black slavery throughout their empire. You contrast the concern of the Parliament with the freeing of black slaves while they heartlessly had cruelty inflicted on the white slaves in England. And can you tell my audience about this?
Yes, that is an incredible story, Pastor Peters. What you had happening was, here was the House of Lords meeting in they were very proud of themselves. They had a tremendous sense of their self-righteousness. They were now going to be freeing the black slaves around their colonies. and this was a badge of their tremendous benevolence. Actually, what it was is a way of assuaging their guilt for what they were doing, the millions and billions that they had made off of the destruction of the white working classes and the poor classes. And the actual scene is this. Picture the Houses of Parliament, these gilded rooms, and these very wealthy men convening over the welfare and soliciting for the welfare of these black people who were no kin to them. Meanwhile, climbing up the chimney of this House of Parliament were 6 and 7 year old boys who were going up there, who were enslaved to chimney sweeps, who were being catching cancer from the cinders that were in the chimneys. 6 and 7 year old boys worked to death in these chimneys. Often the chimneys, not necessarily in the Houses of Parliament, but other chimneys throughout Georgian and Hanover in England, would collapse on these children. Sometimes they were forced up into a chimney that still had a fire in it, because there would be a big banquet going on, and there'd be a chimney fire, and they would extinguish the chimney fire, but the chimney was still hot, and they wanted to get on with the meal, and they would force the child, or beat the child, to go up the chimney. Now, many times, reformers, such as Jacob Hanwell, raised reform bills in Parliament to abolish chimney sweeping among children under the age of 10. And, Pastor Peters, they could not get that bill passed in Parliament because people like David Ricardo said that it would be an affront to the rights of property.
This is Pastor Peters, and I hope you enjoyed the interview that I had in years gone by with Mr. Hoffman, author of the book, They Were White and They Were Slaves. If you want that book, we want to send it to you, but you can't get it for free. And you didn't get this broadcast for free. You may think you did, but we had to pay for it. So remember that, as we do not solicit funds from you, but from time to time we make known to you that the Scriptures for America Worldwide Broadcasting Network needs your support. Check us out at sfawbn.com, and there you'll see the schedule for our network. If you'd like to order that book, They Were White and They Were Slaves, you ought to do it while you can still get it, while they haven't outlawed it just yet. You write to us at Scriptures for America, Post Office Box 766, La Porte, Colorado, 80535. That's Scriptures for America, Post Office Box 766, La Porte, Colorado, 80535. Go to our website, scripturesforamerica.org, to learn about this ministry that broadcasts on the SFAWBN network. Go to SFAWBN.com website to find out what all is going on in the SFAWBN network.
Okay, Mose, we back. Now, at this point, it has been explained. This guy has explained it all. Caucasian people enslaved other Caucasian people. So therefore, no reparations are owed to people of African descent for slavery. I like to open up the phone lines at this point. So go ahead, if you got a question or comment, go ahead and raise your hand, and I'll open up the line so you can get in, and you can explain to me what you've seen. Now, they were enslaved in Britain. They were enslaved in Barbados. They were enslaved in the other islands. And so, therefore, we don't owe them anything for us enslaving them, because we enslaved our own self first. This is some of the most amazing thinking that I have ever seen in my life. I've listened to this thing 3 times today when I could, is to make sure I was hearing what I thought I was hearing. It is quite interesting to hear something like this. But if you got any questions or comments, go ahead and raise your hand, open up the line, Now, keep in mind that it became less amazing to me when this gentleman was asked the question if he was a Christian. And he said that, yes, he's a Christian. And, of course, the network that he's on is a Christian network. So we're going to come back to this stuff here. But let us check out some other stuff, and we're going to get to the Moors also. But let me go over here and deal with the Christianity part, because the guy, he spent about 34 minutes telling us why Europeans, they did owe the Japanese, they did owe the Chinese, they did owe the Indians, all of them got paid, but they don't owe us anything because they enslaved themselves first. Okay. Oh. Whoa. Yeah, hold your hat. Now, to register with your government, go to MortgageAmericanGov.com. We're going to put that there in the inside the chat room, along with everything else that we'll have to put there for you.
And, it's not, they don't need an army. Army is for the Europeans, because he goes in and conquer people, colonize people, destroy people's culture, rape their women, take their natural resources, okay, and force them into the way of his thinking. So our ancestors had no jails. They didn't have any crooks and thieves. Mm-hmm. Okay, they didn't have that. Nobody breaking into somebody's house, taking their television out of there. They didn't have all that. They didn't have no money system. Well, yeah, I got to have me some money. Nobody was on drugs. You know, I got to give me some money to keep my habit up. And all, they didn't have all of that. You see? And they had three forms of writing, like I said before. Highly educated people. All of civilization came from them. So that Ptolemy II is the son of Ptolemy I. And you can read in history as you search. You'll run across Ptolemy II, Philadelphia, in your readings. But whatever you run across that, if you run across Ptolemy II, Philadelphia, anything you hear about it is a lie. Okay. Now, let's go to Ptolemy III, Euergetes I. Ptolemy III, Euergetes I. Time, 246-221 BC. Very important, something happened there. After this image that we know as Serapis, now known as Jesus the Christ, was created, they tried to get our ancestors in the secular community, the grassroots community, to accept and worship this image. Our ancestors said, no, we're not going to do that. Who created this image for the Europeans was the Uncle Tom's of antiquity, the Melkite Coptic Egyptian. Just that few. Okay? Those Condoleezza Rice, Clarence Uncle Tom Addis, and all those kind of people. Okay? They were your Melkites. They go along with a few crumbs that the Greeks gave them. You know? So they created an image for this European to be put into the sacred temples of ancient Egypt, and it was refused. You see? So now, they'll tell you, which is another lie, that Aristotle was a teacher of Alexander the Great. You heard that?
Mm-hmm.
And that this Aristotle had written hundreds of books, and that this Alexander created a library to house his books, known as the Great Library of Egypt. Another lie. Okay? Another lie. Why do I say that? Because I have a marker to go by. What is that marker? Is that our ancestors, the ancient Egyptians, were the first and oldest civilized people on earth, therefore having and created an alphabet, the only alphabet and the only literate people on earth. So therefore, how can Aristotle write hundreds of books to go into a great library of Egypt that supposed was built by Alexander the Greek? How can that be? Why? Why do I say that? I'm saying that there's never been a Socrates, a teacher of Plato. Plato is supposed to be a teacher of Aristotle. Never been an Aristotle, never been a Herodotus, never been a Euripides, never been a Homer, Pythagoras, Hippocrates, etc. Why? Because if a person insists that these Greek names existed, those Greek names were supposed to have existed before Alexander coming to Egypt. And when Alexander came into Egypt, the Greeks forced the Greek language on our ancestors, the ancient Egyptians, and the ancient Egyptians learned that language, and by them being a literate people, they applied an alphabet to it. So any name Greek coming into Egypt, supposed to have writings and so forth and so on, the question has to be asked, what alphabet did they use? Greeks had no alphabet. You see? So, Ptolemy, go back to your Ptolemaic dynasty. Ptolemy III, you get his one, built the great library, what is known as the Serapeum Temple in Memphis, in Alexandria, Egypt. The Serapeum Temple. Okay? And what he did, because his grandfather told him in one life, he had closed out all the temples throughout Egypt. And he took the writings and those scroll manuscripts and housed them into that Serapeum Temple, that annex building, and that annex building is known as the Great Library of Egypt. Not that other lies that's attached to that Great Library. And I put that in my historical origin of Christianity. Okay? So these are some of the things that you need to know as to what happened to our ancestors, the ancient Egyptians, after the Greeks came into Egypt. Okay? Now, let's go down to the fifth Ptolemy. Ptolemy number five. Epiphanes. Ptolemy number five, Epiphanes, Eucharistos. You heard of the Epiphany?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm.
It's called Little Christ, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's where it comes from. See? That's the epiphany that they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But then, I'm just bringing that to your attention so you can continue your study. So if you run into these different things, mm-hmm. then you'll be aware of what's going on.
Said Little Christ.
Mm-hmm. Little Christ. The epiphany. Mm-hmm. And it goes from the 26th of December all the way to the 6th of January.
Little Christmas. Oh.
It's called Little Christmas. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's also called the 12th night, mm-hmm. all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And the Epiphany, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They're worshiping, the Epiphany is worshiping the Greek Orthodox Church and the Roman Catholic Church, some form of the Roman Catholic and other Orthodox churches. So, I want to bring that to your attention. Now, so we're moving right along, right?
Mm-hmm.
In the meantime, every Greek Ptolemy thereafter, now you go back to Ptolemy one, flag he called Sotar, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is mm-hmm. Savior. Every, the other 13 Ptolemies that make up the Ptolemaic Greek dynasty of Egypt, every one of them tried to get our ancestors to accept this image to worship it, and they fought against it. It's correct. They fought against it for 921 years. Okay, 921 years. Now, we're going to go into the Ecumenical Council. Very important. We're going to fast forward. Now, this image was made and given the name Serapis to this Ptolemaic ruler of ancient Egypt, the successor of Alexander the Great, right? So for 600, this was done in 320 BC. BC dates you count down. So for 600 years or more, a little bit more, slight, you know, 4 or 5 years, 604 or 5 years later, you're coming up to the council that is known as the Ecumenical Council of Nicaea 1, 325. You got that?
Yes.
Now we're into the ABCE era. You can't say that you're in the Christian era because there's no Christ then. We're gonna show you how Christ, when Christ comes in. Okay? So we're in an era when BC time ran out. See, when you go, you count those dates down until you get to zero, now you're going to the dates that we use today when you go up in the count. Follow me? But I can't say, that's AD. Anno Domini. No, after the death of our Lord. No. Okay? Right. See, so therefore, I use in my book, The Short Order of Christianity, ABCE, after BCE ran out. Okay? But she wasn't going to catch me with my pants down. But she said there was no Christ. You're using AD. But anyway, here we are at the world's first religious ecumenical council to be convened. And we're talking about the Council of Nicaea 1. And you'll find the four council meetings in my book, The Historical Origin of Christianity. It's in there. And then we're going to go into other council meetings that you probably never heard of before. Okay? But we're going to go into them. And those other five council meetings is in my book, The Historical Origin of Islam. Are we together?
Yeah.
Now, I'm concerned, I'm the only scholar out here that is telling you the three major events that caused the Council of Nicaea 1 to come into being. Mm-hmm. And those, it's in my book, The Historical Origin of Christianity. I hear you. One is called the Donatus Schismatic Controversy. Two, the donation of Constantine. And three, the strong statement by Arius. Okay, let's peek into that a little bit. The Donatus Schismatic Controversy was a controversy that was came about in North Africa in the 4th century. Okay? Now, that controversy came about when, and you got, in Africa, you got two factions at that time. You got the Melkite Uncle Tom faction, and you got the grassroots faction of us, okay? Fighting against the system that the Greeks had set up over there, okay? Refusing to worship that image that we know today as Jesus the Christ. So, our grassroots secular community was constantly under attack by the Greeks. Okay? So, just like we are today in America, we are constantly under attack by the system that the Europeans have created. Okay? And We are non-citizens of this country as a result. So therefore, we have no rights. Because Roger Brooke Tanning, who was the head of the Supreme Court in 1857, said in the Dred Scott decision that Negroes had no rights for a white man to respect.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that he also said that Dred Scott was not a citizen, so therefore could not bring him. And then he also said that we were so inferior that we should not even be around white folk. Mm-hmm. Get a lot of nerve.
Yeah. Yeah.
See? So now, when you know and find out that we as a people, you as a person, we as a group of people are descendants of the greatest people who ever worked, walked this earth, known to us today in history as the ancient Egyptian, what happened to white supremacy? It's dead. It's over with.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's over.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We're back, Morris. Now, the last statement that Dr. Walter Williams made was one of the most profound statements that I've ever heard, and he's dead on point with that, in my opinion. Once you come into the knowledge of yourself and you start examining all the aspects of what you have done and all the magnificence that you have done and the greatness that you are, it's over. It's over. The nightmare is over. All you got to do is, you know, when you approach with this, that, and the other, you can say, well, excuse me, that's okay, but I'm the son of God. So I'm, you know, they're going to try to talk you down, treat you some kind of way because they don't want you to know who you are. Because if you know who you are, then it is over. Because the record of your ancient story bears it out. There is no defense for that. It's just a matter of you knowing who you are. But anytime you adopt somebody else's philosophy about who you are, then you got a problem. We need to learn how to separate things, use certain things that we can use, and throw the rest of the garbage that we don't. That we don't need. Now, if anybody got any disagreements with that, go ahead and raise your hand. Because, you know, if you know who you are, how can someone come and tell you something about something that you know is a lie? That's why it is so important for us to study and on a regular basis and to learn. See, the brain is like a bucket with a hole in it. You can fill that bucket up with water, but the water keep dripping out over a period of time. We thought that since we got a degree and we left high school with a diploma and we left college with a degree, that was it. I mean, that we don't need nothing else. That we, as long as we got that right there, we don't have to do nothing else. But the mind, the brain went right on forgetting. And so if you look back into the annals of your own ancestors, they tell you it doesn't matter who you are and how long you've been doing what you've been doing. As long as you continue to realize who you are, and the only way you're going to do that, you're going to keep on studying and keep on putting worthwhile information in the brain, because that is a major defense mechanism that you can use. And so we're going to move on. We're going to go into another segment and get some more background on this thing. And if any of you got some questions or comments, go ahead and raise your hand and I'll open
up the line. I also know civilization's debt to Islam. It was Islam that places like Uluzad that carried the light of learning through so many centuries, paving the way for Europe's Renaissance and Enlightenment. It was innovation in Muslim communities. It was innovation in Muslim communities that developed the order of algebra, our magnetic compass and tools of navigation. our mastery of pens and printing, our understanding of how disease spreads and how it can be healed. Islamic culture has given us majestic arches and soaring spires, timeless poetry and cherished music, endless poetry and places of peaceful contemplation. And throughout history, Islam has demonstrated through words and deeds the possibilities of religious tolerance and racial equality. I also know that Islam has always been a part of America's story. The first nation to recognize my country was Morocco. In signing the Treaty of Tripoli in 1796, our second president, John Adams, wrote, "The United States has in itself no character of enmity against the laws, religion, or tranquility of Muslims." And since our founding, American Muslims have enriched the United States. They have fought in our wars, they have served in our government, they have stood for civil rights, they have started businesses, they have taught at our universities, they've excelled in our sports arenas, they've won Nobel Prizes, built our tallest building, and lit the Olympic torch. And when the first Muslim American was recently elected to Congress, he took the oath to defend our Constitution using the same Holy Quran that one of our founding fathers, Thomas Jefferson, kept in his personal library. So I have known Islam on three continents before coming to the region where it was first revealed. That experience guides my conviction that partnership between America and Islam must be based on what Islam is, not what it isn't. And I consider it part of my responsibility as President of the United States to fight against negative stereotypes of Islam wherever they appear. But that same principle must apply to Muslim perceptions of America. Just as Muslims do not fit a crude stereotype, America is not the crude stereotype of a self-interested empire. The United States has been one of the greatest sources of progress that the world has ever known.
Okay, that was Barack Obama. Now, that's interesting.
The Ashanti in ancient America. Although there is considerable evidence about African tribes in ancient America, especially the Olmecs, very little is known about other African tribes that Europeans found when they entered the Americas, especially in South America. In Ashanti in ancient America, we will discuss one of the important groups that lived here, the Ashanti. Much of the information that we know about ancient Africans in Mexico are related to the Olmecs. For example, in Atlantis in Mexico, Dr. Clyde Winter provides an exhaustive account of the Olmec people. You can order his book from lulu.com. Constantine Rafinis is an important scholar of the 19th century. Dr. Rafinis wrote extensively on the ancient inhabitants of the Americas. Rafinis published an important research journal during this time called the Atlantic Journal. In the Atlantic Journal, he wrote about many issues relating to the Americas. Dr. Constantine Rafinis was sure that there were many African Indians in the Americas. These Indians had Negro features, physical features, and spoke African languages. Dr. Rafinis was sure that one of the most prominent African Indian groups was, in a sense, the Yoruba people. An important paper written about the ancient Americas was an article written in 1832 called The Primitive Black Nations of America. In this article, Rapanese talked about the Yoruba people. The Yoruba people, he found, spoke a language that was related to the Ashanti or Fante speaking people of West Africa. The Ashanti and Fante people belong to the Akan ethnic group. The Akan ethnic group is made up of a number of people. The Akan are divided into matriarchal clans, or Abusua, and a dozen, and there's a dozen kingdoms that make up the Akan Empire. The earth female deity is connected to fertility, and this is the main god of the ancient Ashanti or Akan people. We find, in a sense, that the Fante people are usually associated or called the coastal Akan because they live near the coastal areas of West Africa. The Ashanti people, who really are called Asante people, live in the interior. According to oral traditions, the Akan people migrated from the north part of Ghana to occupy southern Ghana. Today, you can find the Akan people from Ghana to Ivory Coast on along the coast to Togo. The Asante or Akan people are very important. The Asante people had a very important religion, and they were very studious about their belief in their gods and stools. Stools indicated status and power among the succession of chiefs and kings. In fact, one of the leading kings of the Asante, Abu Kramupa, in a sense fought an important battle against the British. And in these wars, the Ashanti tried to keep control of their country until much later in the 20th century. Asante is the British corruption of the name Asante. Fante is just one of the tribes that belong to the Akan. The Ashanti have a matriarchal society, and the king of the Ashanti is usually succeeded by his nephew. Among the Ashanti, the main god is called Onyame. He is the high god. Priests are called Ose. The Yoruba people of South America are people that lived along the Orinoco River in Suriname and Venezuela. Padre Gumila, a Jesuit priest, conducted research among the Indians who lived on the Orinoco River. He provides us with information about the Yoruba Indians. Joseph Gumila wrote descriptions of native life along the Orinoco River. His discussion of local healing practices was critical in showing people that South Americans had their own unique science and civilization. He wrote about the Yoruba, or African tribe, that lived along the Orinoco. He found that the people who were included in the Yoruba tribe had very high science. Grumilla's work is very informative about the Yoruba and other South American people. This is written in his book, El Orinoco Ilustrado, Historia Natural Civil y Geográfica de Estero Gran Río. Here is a picture of the American Indians conducting one of their medical procedures and their cultural activities. Here we also find, in a sense, a very important picture, and in this picture we see their use of various plants. And in fact, many Europeans, by studying the people, the Yoruba and other South American people, learned about many plants that have helped Europeans to maintain their science. Here we can see, in a sense, some of the fishing and cultural areas of the Yoruba people. According to Daniel Garrison Britton, in 1701, Grumilla said that there were around 3,000 Yoruba and Biatoya people living in nearby communities on the Orinoco River. The Yoruba inhabit an area stretching from Guyana to Choco. Rabanese collected Yoruba vocabulary. In evidence that a nation of American descendants of Ham now inhabit a district of South America, in this article, Rabanese compared the vocabulary items to African languages and found that they were related to Ashanti or the Fante language. Rabanese found that 40% of the Yoruba language is related to Ashanti. The Yoruba language was spoken from the Meta to the Kasanari and Kakida to the foothills of the mountains of New Granada. The Yoruba may have established the Velenoid and Aquarinoid culture series in period 4. These sites are situated along the middle and lower Orinoco River. As mentioned earlier, the Orinoco River was the main settlement area for blacks in the New World coming directly from Africa. In 1650, many runaway slaves began to join the Yoruba people. These slaves fled slavery in Dutch Guiana, Suriname. Here they joined the black Indian tribes living along the Orinoco River. Today, instead of calling these black people Yurura, they are usually called the Bush Blacks or the Bush Negroes. The Bush Blacks are divided into two tribes, the Saramaca and the Ukon, the Akan. The Akan or the Ukon, they have many games that they play related to African games, such as Wari, Mancala, and Aji. Melvin Herskovitz, who was a student of the Bush African culture, found in a sense that much of the Bush Black culture is related to the Ashanti people of West Africa. Among the Bush Blacks, we find many combs and stools, things that are popular not only among the so-called Bush Blacks, but also, in a sense, the Ashanti. The name of the Bush Black God is called Obosimo. This corresponds to the Twi term for God, Obosam. The name of the thunder god among the various Bush Black people also, in a sense, relate to the Twi word Tata, which means father. So we find that many of the thunder gods are called Tata. The snake god of the Bush Blacks is called Anamino. This corresponds to the Twi word Onini, for, in a sense, the python god. What we find is that many of the terms that were used by the Yurura and the various Bush Blacks were terms, in a sense, that have a Fante, or, in a sense, the language of the Akan, Twi, etymology. But what we find, in a sense, that often among the Bush Blacks, words that had an A sound were changed, words that had an O sound, in a sense, really relate to an A sound in some of the other dialects. The earth god of the Bush Blacks was called, in a sense, the great ancestor. We find, in a sense, that among the Akan, and also, in a sense, among the various Ashanti people, we find, in a sense, that fertility is a very important thing. As a result, we find that many of the idols and statues made by the Bush Blacks and Ashanti relate to our fertility. We also find among the Bush Blacks that the word for soul was Akra. This is also, in a sense, the Twi word for soul. We find, in a sense, many spider stories common among the Akan and Bush Blacks. Among the Bush Blacks, as in Africa, the spider stories relate to Anansi. We find, in a sense, that it's very interesting, Akan and Bush Blacks. Among the Bush Blacks, as in Africa, the spider stories relate to Anansi. We find, in a sense, that it's very interesting that these Akan or Yurura people probably founded the earliest civilizations along the Orinoco River. The Yurura may have established the Velenoid and Araquanid culture series around 1150 to 1500 BC. These sites are situated along the middle and lower Orinoco River. We find, in a sense, that many of their art relates back to artifacts that are found in Africa. According to Alfred Kidder, the mounds of Venezuela are situated along local rivers. Practically all the ancient figurines from Venezuela are Africans. African males are commonly represented on many ancient American sites. The art from Venezuela, on the other hand, indicate that many of the African settlers were females. This probably relates to the fact that among the Yurura, as most Akan people, the female or fertility was an important part of their art and culture. Here we see some artifacts from the Valencia style, and we can clearly see the female figure. We find in these figures that the head of the female is very large. And if you remember those artifacts we've seen earlier relating to Akan art today, we find that the female usually has a large head, but the body is somewhat smaller. Here we see the same style in the Valencia style. The Vinland cord style comprises pottery from the mound sites of the Valencia Basin. Here the dead were buried in urns identical to those used in West Africa. The Vilancoy pottery is usually red and white, while some were tricolored pottery, red, black, and white, as in the El Topo style. The Vilancoy people also made collars decorated with human faces. The artifacts from Valencia correspond to artifacts discovered by the French scholar Desplanges when he excavated mounds along the Niger River at the turn of the 20th century. In the funeral chambers of these mounds, he found numerous pots with a red slip and copper instruments. The Niger being painted wearer is of the white on dark red brown variety. It corresponds to the white on red painted product from El Mayo style of Venezuela. What we find in a sense is that this is a unique culture. We find in a sense that the Ashanti people, somewhere back in ancient times, somewhere before in a sense the 10th century, made their way to ancient America. Along the Orinoco River, they built a fantastic, a beautiful and wonderful culture. A culture that we are happy to know today. And from this culture, we know that in addition to the Olmecs, other African people made their way to ancient America.
Okay, Morris, let's deal with this situation here. We got some people that said, okay, we're not Moors. We don't know what you're saying. We're gonna deal with that for a minute. But before we do, let me mention the fact that a lot of the stuff you can actually see in my archives in video format. And I've gotten the best that I could to put up here for you in audio so that you can get a gist of what's going on and draw the conclusion right there in your own mind. But for those of you who have my archive, you can go right in there to there are several places you can go and race in ancient African history and the Moors and action and so on and so forth. And it's all there for you to see. But now what we're finna deal with is something a little bit different, and if you all disagree, you can go ahead and raise your hand. I'm going to run this in a little plug here, and let me know what you think, okay? So y'all sit tight, and we'll get right on into this.
Ishmael, can I ask you some question about the Moors?
About the Moors, yes, sir. I'd be happy to answer if I can. Yes. Absolutely.
All right. And I don't mean to come at you sideways. It's just I'm very skeptical when it comes to the Moors, so I just wanted to ask you some questions for clarification.
Certainly.
To your knowledge, what's the oldest record of a Moor calling himself or another person Moor?
The oldest records that I could find of when Moors actually started to be applied to a group of people was in the 3rd century B.C. This is when it went from basically the landmass, which was the area near Mauritania, being applied to the people that were in that particular region. There were also times in history where the Persians were being, recognized as Moors, as well as even before the 3rd century BCE, you'll find records of M-O-R being applied to those of the Asiatic, what they call Asiatics, which are basically in the India region. They were referred to as Moors as well. But the Moors that are recognized as far as in the African continent or the sub-Saharan area or even in that particular area, I would say it's 3rd century BC, and the older name of those particular Moors you'll find are the Nar.
All right. I think the Nar is subjected to debate because I've heard the two shows, and I think it's your own personal claim. I don't think it's been established. But, you know, when you say the 3rd century BC, what is the actual record that you that's mentioning Moor?
Yes, sir. 3rd century B.C., you'll find out that the basic trade was being set up by the Phoenicians. And when the Phoenicians were setting up the trade along with the Romans, there was a body of people, or actually the people that were the residents of the Mauritania area. they were it went from the people that were living in the Mauritania area. That's when it started to go from the landmass Mauritania to the people. They accepted the name or they defined themselves as Moors, and they actually ended up entering into treaties with the Phoenicians and the Romans at that time. And that's when it went from the landmass of Mauritania to the people that were living there, which were the Moors. And that, was actually a part of there were actually like landmasses and cities in the area as well.
All right, but you see, I mean, so far you're telling me about Mauritania, but that's not the Moors themselves who named the land Mauritania, was it?
Yes, yes, sir.
So who named it not Mauritania?
Mauritania was a name. I believe Mauritania started from being called by the Greeks. Were calling it Mauritania, but they were.
I believe so as well.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Yeah, go ahead, brother. Yeah, go ahead, brother.
I think it was like the Greeks that were calling it Mauritania at that time, but they weren't calling the people the Moors, because like I said, you'll find the Moors as a name as being used sporadically on different people through the time. But when you talk about a group of people that actually adopted the name as Moors, those are the residents of Mauritania in that 3 century B.C., which,
all
of course, is older than Islam.
Yeah, if that's 3rd century BC, it would be. But once again, when I ask you for a record, you keep telling me that, you know, there was a land called Mauritania, and
right.
You said also that it's probably the Greek who named it that way. But when I ask you for a record of Moors, like a Moor who referred to either himself or other people as Moors, so far you have not given me any record, any document, any evidence whatsoever. So it's basically, because what you're saying, I heard other people saying it. But every time I ask, you know, for anything, there's nothing. Isn't there a record, something that's written where it says Moor, actually?
I'm not sure if they have any records of, if there are any tangible of the treaties that were being entered. What I found out was that the people who were running the trade during that particular time were the Phoenicians, and the Romans at that particular time. As for like an actual paper document, I don't know of any in particular, and that's never been my claim at all, so I'm not quite sure exactly who else would actually make that claim. But I mean, from what I understand is that they actually entered into treaties with the name of Moor, and Moor was a self-defining term. It wasn't something that was applied to them. Those were the people, because when you go into the reason why NAR started to be applied to the Moors is because you can study and find the GNAR people, which is where the Canary Islands come from. The Canary Islands derive from NAR as well. So the NAR and the Moors started to become synonymous during that particular time.
You know, that's interesting. You know, I like the fact that you admit that like you don't know about the national record. Because me personally, I'm going to tell you what I think. I think that the Moors, they tend to, because you see, I was listening to you, and you kept mentioning the Phoenicians. And as far as I'm concerned, they're Phoenicians, but not Moors. And I think what the Moors do, I'm not talking about just you, I'm talking in general. I think they tend to just look at any, like, sort of black people or black empire in history and say that they were actually Moors. And that's the reason why, from now on, I'm going to tend to ask them for records, because I think personally that they come much later, you know, that they come when Islam started, or, you know, later, like 15th century or 18th century. But no matter what, if somebody can give me a record, then I'm like, we can start from there as recorded in history. Because I heard you also mentioning the Persians earlier being Moors.
Yes.
But as far as I'm concerned, I thought the Persians were Indo-Europeans.
So the original Persians are Kushites. So the original Persians that, you know, that were up in that particular region, those were extensions of the Kushite Empire.
I got a quick question. Brother Shaka.
Yes, sir.
You got the book, The Golden Age of the Moors?
No, I don't have it.
Now, look, now what we figured out is, if he's calling himself a Moor and don't got the book, The Golden Age of the Moors, they got to chill out for a minute. And then we also figured out, right, if we want to question that, right, then we also need to at least take a good look at the Golden Age of the Moors. Let me give you this point right here, Shaka, on page 5.
Okay.
It says, at the heart of the history of ancient Moors, right, says Chandler, are the Garamantes. That's Garamantes of the Sahara. The Garamantes were black Africans who occupied much of northern Africa. Probably got to do a case study on the Garamantes, you feel me? And then try to kind of look at, you know, their records and see what they're talking about, so we won't get into a mix-up. But that's a good point you bring out. So maybe we'll try to figure that out. Because, hey, Shinzetti, you did a paper on that word, didn't you?
On the word Moor, yes, I did.
On the Moor. Did you find out how old that word was? Did you or did you not?
Not by day. I just did some linguistic work.
Right.
What I can do is I'm gonna send it to you so that you can send it to people in the
email.
Chat room. Yeah. The purpose. Listen, briefly. The purpose of that paper really wasn't to go against
where the word
what they
came
say
from?
generally about the Moors. It was more so just to disprove that the word came as they implied it from Kemet. That was the main purpose of that paper.
Okay.
So I'm
it was done in a very excellent manner. I know Shinzetti had, you know, checked many sources on that. He had I was able to give him some input on some insight of what I knew. It was very well done. So I would definitely recommend that as well.
That's a good question, Ed O'Shaka.
I think that's definitely a very valid point, Brother Shaka, and I don't try to make like any kind of, you know, unnecessary claims on it. A lot of the history of the term Moor is actually obscure. There are a lot of the records that were destroyed, as well as a lot of history that just simply is not, you know, not found. So there are people who try to, you know, put a square peg into a round hole. But you know, I try to verify the information that I know. But I know that there's a rich history of, you know, how the Visigoths came into play and where the whole Moorish history, you know, started to change. You have to study the part of that Visigoth history as well.
Yeah, and you know, I appreciate the way you're handling this, Brother Ishmael, because I'm kind of the same way. When it's something I don't know, I say it straight up. And once again, the reason I was wondering that, because, I mean, I usually don't pay attention to the Moors, because as far as I'm concerned, their fence riding, they claim so many civilizations and so many languages and stuff, even with the religion and species, because as far as I can see, it's like the Moors, unless it can be proven that there's a record for the 3rd century B.C., as far as I can see, it looks like the Moors, they were like mainly Muslims. Basically, they were black Muslims. And so they would still try to claim that they were not Muslims, that, you know, they are Muslims, or that they don't have no religion, which is strange to me. And also, I had read the article from Shinzetti back then when I was on Facebook, and it appears that the word Moor actually comes from the Europeans. Just like the name Mauritania, it appears that it comes from the Europeans. So I'm like, here are those people claiming to be so ancient using European terms, and also terms that we can, like, date. So my thing is that the Moors, once again, in general, as far as I can see, they tend to really try to make themselves way more ancient than they are. They try to make themselves like they were there so long ago, and I really think it's not the case, once again. Now, I might be wrong, but then it's up to the Moors. Any Moors listening, you know, you have a dude, I don't really want to say his name, but they call the shows and talking all this and all of that, but I'm like, you know, show me some records of people, you know, calling each other Moor or somebody else Moor. Now, if it's not, then it's another business. I think then, in this case, the Moors, they should call themselves Nar. And the other thing I would like to...
I understand where you're coming from. Just keep one thing in mind is that, like I said, the first recorded part of Moor that can be verified as far as the African continent is 3rd century B.C., Islam as a religion didn't come into existence until 575-80 AD. And so you also have the, but you also have the people like, you know, St. Maurice. St. Maurice was from Kemet, and he was recognized as a Moor. And this was in the B.C. years. So we do have a history of Moors be in existence well before Islam even came into existence as a religion. Although the majority of Moors are Islamic, but there are also Jewish Moors. There are, you know, I mean, there are different versions as far as religious background, as well as when you deal with the Nahr history, you're actually dealing with a lot of indigenous African culture being applied and making it synonymous with Moor as well. So it isn't just limited to Islam, but of course the vast majority of them do practice Islam as well.
But I would like to jump on what you said, because once again, you mentioned that the earliest record is the 3rd century B.C.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But when I asked you earlier, you couldn't tell me that it wasn't clear. So are you telling me what is the actual record that mentions Moors in the 3rd century B.C.?
I think there are some of the written Greek. Yeah, I think it's on some of the written Greek records. The specific written records I don't happen to have on the top of my head, but I could track them down for you, I'm sure.
You tell me that in that document in the 3rd century B.C. it mentions Moor?
No. Well, can I step in real fast?
Let me step in real quick. I'm going to use that book again. Here's that book again, The Golden Age of the Moors. Watch this.
He comes right in, he says, it was such. He says, populations that largely comprised of the Moorish people, called Moors from the Greek Morenes, the Roman Moronos, dark, because the attribute of blackness which sharply distinguished them from the bulk of the European people. And so they was like Morenos, right? That's what they were saying. You know what I'm saying? Then you get the Moors. So they was called Morenos, right? Or Moros, before they was called Moors in Greek record. You know, a lot of Moors don't say that. That's a fact. You feel me? That's on page 4. You can look that up, the etymology on that.
Was there anything as Spanish in the 3rd century B.C.?
Was there Spanish? I'm telling you, Romans don't speak Spanish. The Romans speak
Latin.
Some form of Latin.
So Spanish.
That's a Latin word.
So Spanish came.
Moros.
All right, because you just said that they were called Morenos, and then they were called Moors. That's what you said, right?
Yeah. Right, it comes out of that.
Obviously, that means they couldn't have been called Moors in the 3rd century B.C.
That's interesting, but I know the Greeks called them M-A-U-R-E-S, and the Romans called them M-A-U-R-U-S, and it denotes blackness. And see, if a Moor tried to get away from that word meaning blackness, then that's when he started messing himself up, right?
Let me jump in just real quick. Just to clear for our listener audience, when you only say Moor, M-O-O-R, that is the anglicized form. Anglicized meaning English-speaking form of Morenos. Of course, you have these different dialects and languages. So hundreds of years ago, it would have been or thousands ago, it would have been Moore or Mooros. Okay? It would have been like that. And then when the English and British start picking up on it, they reduced it to M-O-O-R as far as the pronunciation. It still would be the same meaning and word.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So basically, what you just said, Sanjeti, is that basically it comes from it was a Roman term then, as far as we can track back.
Most records are going to take it back. Even if you go on etymonline.com or go to Etymological Dictionary, most of them are going to take it back to the Greek.
The Greek, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, most are going to take it back to the Greek.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm in agreement with that. As far as the records that I understand, it comes from one of the versions of when the Greeks and the Phoenicians were doing their trade. So that the original Greeks were black as well. But to me, it comes from like a Greek term. But like I said, the oldest people that was applied to were the Nahrs. So
let me add one quick thing, Shaka. I sent you a copy of the paper that I wrote.
Okay, let me get that.
Yeah. I already sent it to you, the linguistic analysis of the word Moor. Okay. And that paper does over 15 references, okay, linguistic references, et cetera. So you can check that out. Now, the word Moore, or Moros, it does not stop at the Greek, okay? It does go into older Indo-European languages and any words related to it. It's all in that paper, so hopefully people can pick that up. I can post that in the chat room.
I wanted to say that, you know, once again with the Moors, like, I think it's kind of hypocritical of them saying that Africa is either a misnomer or not a term we should use because it's allegedly named after a European, when Sanjeli just said that it goes back to either Greek or Indo-European terms. I think it's very hypocritical. And besides, I even heard Ismail Allah said one or two shows back, what a few people know anyway, that the continent wasn't named after Scipio Africanus because he didn't have his name as a birth name. He only took the name after after his conquest, after he conquered in that particular area at that war. But I want to say to everybody, we have to be very careful, and that's what they were in primary sources. Yeah, I don't have no degree, and I didn't go that far in like the academic system, but I'm considering myself thorough because I usually deal with the primary sources, and you cannot go wrong when you deal with archaeology. And I want to say also we have to be careful. For example, like we might have some scholars that say some things, like even Ivan Versotima, though I haven't read his book. But once again, Sheikh Antadiop, he said that the Moors were Arabs. I spoke to a woman from Senegal, and she knows because she's been over there, and she knows she speaks the language, and she was telling me about Moors in Mauritania. And today what they are doing, basically they are Arabs or some of them mixed, and what they are doing, they are enslaving dark-skinned black people. Like they have them working for them, and when it's time to pay, they just don't pay them. They tell them, no, because you're a slave. You're dark-skinned, you're black, and that's what it is. So people really need to chill and do their research. And the reason I was saying we should be careful, because there's, for example, Ashwa Kwesi, who's been to Kemet for like 40 years, I think, or 30 years plus. And for those who have seen DVDs or excerpts online, it usually says that in the temples in Kemet, it says, know thyself. That's something that I think a lot of people have heard. But I heard Manu Wempin, and Brother Ong was interviewing him, and Manu Wempin, he said he has yet to see know thyself written on the temple in Kemet.
That's right.
So, and I think Manu Wempin mentioned that the reason why Ashwa Kwesi and other people say that is because it's written in a book. I'm not sure if it's a stolen legacy, but it's written in one of our elders' books. So people just started quoting, and that's it. So, you know, some things like that, we have to be very careful. You have to speak about what we know. And that's just a hint for everybody listening that when you're talking about history, sometimes an author might make a claim, might say, well, those people, they were called this, or they used to do that. If they just say that, you can take it as an allegation. Now, if they said because that document is so, or they give you a reference, then it's something, yes, it's backed up, you know, it's substantiated, you know. And with the Moors, a lot of time, they just make claims. They say, like, for example, if you look at, I'm sorry, I don't want to be too long, but if you look at the debate in Fedi and Alim Bey, what Alim Bey does, he shows some artifact that's allegedly like 1 million years ago or so many stuff like that. And that's what the Moors tend to do, talk about stuff that's so long ago to say, look, we were here. But I'm like, hold on, what do you mean we? That's not the Moors. Just black people, you know, and I think that's a big problem I have. So once again, you know, anytime the Muslims have that stuff, remember the 3 points of Lame Scholarship, that's no name, no dates, no places, places meaning locations. So if they cannot give you any reference, you need to know where it starts. I mean, in history, you might have studied before, maybe people are not writing, but we're talking about what we know, you understand? So that's something I want to say to yourself.
Okay, Moses, we back. That's very, very, very interesting. And what I'm finding out more and more is that when Africans, people in this century, are coming inside the United States, there is something waiting on them, and it is called division and separatism. There are things that have been put in place automatically to separate and divide and make sure that there's absolutely no unity between this particular species of people. I mean, the way I see it is, okay, we had slavery, We had the Indians almost driven into the so-called Indians, almost driven into extinction. We have the Chinese that was enslaved, and World War II came. We had the Japanese enslaved and all of this. But what is it about this particular species of people that we call black that is being written out of the so-called respectable, so-called commentary of history worldwide? What is it? What? Why? Why is this particular species of being being blocked by Arabs, Caucasians, Spanish, Mexican, everybody? They keep this one down. No, this is him. We can't. Why? What is it about this particular species? Why this one? Why, man? What is this thing? I mean, this situation is global. Now, if any of you got can give me an answer to that, go ahead and raise your hand. I'll open up the line so you can tell me why. Let's run over to Europe and see what's going over there, and then we come right on back. Y'all hold your hat. Here we go.
There are those on YouTube and elsewhere who wish to deny the black African presence in Europe. They post their little videos with drawings and things depicting Moors as other than black, and would suggest to you that if there were blacks involved in the Moorish expansion in Europe, then they would be black slaves. The ignorant would have you believe that the only role that black Africans have played historically is as slaves. Now, these images tell the story. Not much more needs to be said. And of course, the ignorant and uninformed Eurocentrist and white supremacist would suggest that perhaps these are relatively recent artifacts created by Afrocentrists and a fantasy. I'm not going to give you a history on these images and who these characters represent and where they are found at even today, because I would prefer that the detractors go ahead and expose their own ignorance by making such statements. Historians and those who know, and those who are art curators and such, understand and know the value of the artifacts you are looking at. Most of the detractors could never afford even the most inexpensive of these objects because they are historical truths. They represent a time when people who looked like the images you are looking at were in control. And we're not talking about Africa, we're talking about Europe. And that's a history that most people do not know about, and many of those who do know want to deny it. They want to make the Moors something other than what they were. Again, these images speak for themselves. We're not looking at slaves. We're looking at the people that were in control and had the wealth and brought knowledge and education to a country that was fading, basically drowning in its own urine, so to speak. What they call the Dark Ages, a culture to where it was considered a sin to take a bath. Again, the artifacts we are looking at are historical, extremely valuable, and you can go to Europe for yourself, to Venice, to Germany, to Madrid, to Luxembourg, and see many of these artifacts, which are there even to this day. Those who would deny the truth sometimes know the truth, but just don't want others to find out the truth. See, I'm showing images that no person in their right mind would ever suggest are other than Negroid. Many of the Moors were of a lighter skin complexion, particularly after a period of time. They were there for approximately seven centuries, over 700 years, that they were in control. And as it usually is with invaders, they do not bring their women and children with them. The women of the culture they overthrow become the spoils of war. So there does become a lightening of complexions. So if you think about it, it only makes sense that if the Moors invaded and did not bring their own women with them and instead took wives and concubines from the natives who were of a white complexion for the most part, that eventually their offspring would become lighter and lighter. It is a historical fact that the Moors at some point required in certain cities 100 virgins to be given to them as tribute. And from those 100 white virgins, they had children who did in fact rise to positions of leadership within the Moorish Empire. So, of course, there was a lightening of the complexion of the Moors, but what you're looking at is authentic, genuine, original Moors, the Black Moors, the ones that those who represent Eurocentricity want to deny ever existed.
Okay, Moes, we're back. Now, this is quite interesting because now we're talking about being in Europe, and we got the word Europe, Europa. When I was in school, they taught us a story about Helen of Troy and the launching of 1,000 ships and all of this stuff. And but one of the most interesting things, and for those of you who don't have the book, The Golden Empire of the Moors, I suggest you get that book. That is a very, very powerful book. Also, while you're at it, get The Moors in Spain by Stanley Lane Poole, who actually puts the timeline of events, because see, what we have a problem with is the timeline of events. If we can get people, places, times and events, then anything that has been added into the actual ongoing slot from the beginning of time and moving all the way down through time to the current time, we'll be able to identify it, remove it from the ancient story, and put it where it belongs. We want to start with labels. First, we want to examine the word black, Negro, colored, African-American, Afro-American, to test these things and see if they coincide with a landmass like Chinese, Mexican, Puerto Rican, Cuban, the India, which matches with the Indian. When we have Mexican matching with Mexico, Cuban matching with Cuba, Puerto Rican matching with Puerto Rico, Chinese matching with China, Japanese matching with Japan. And if we can start drawing the correlation to see where and what's not matching, like we have white people, where does that match? Black people, where does that match? If we have Caucasian, we can match that to a specific location. And if we can match it to a specific location, then it has an ancient story. And we can connect it to the ancient story that will give us the nature of the people. It will connect them to their ancient past and their atrocities. all their good deeds, which if there were no atrocities, it won't be there. And there's nothing that we can judge it by today. But if it is there, then we can determine whether or not the behavior existed there and see if it exists anywhere in the future from that time period even unto the day. But when we say white, we have to look up the definition of white and see what that matches. And if we go into Webster's Dictionary and look it up, it says pure as the driven snow, righteous, godlike. So we something is not matching. So if we put things where they belong, then we can actually see where it matches what is supposed to match. When we say black, we can't match nothing, but if we say more or ancient Egyptian or ancient Canaanites or ancient Moabites and ancient Hamites and ancient this and ancient that, then we can connect it to a location. And when we get it to a location, we can examine the ancient behavioral patterns of the people and connect it to their nature, which will tell us where evil is coming from and what is ingrained in righteousness and who it is attached to by their nature. You understand what I'm saying? Now, if I've said something wrong, go ahead and raise your hand, and I'll straighten me out about this. I mean, if I go in the ocean, I know every fish in there has a name, and that name is associated with an ancient story. But if I take that tiny fish and cut his tail off and his head off and put him in a can, I label him as a sardine, I go back in the ocean and look to see where the sardines are in the ancient story, I can't find any sardines because it was manufactured. And so were the titles of Negro, colored, black, African-American, white. All these were manufactured titles for a reason. So what we have to do is we have to do a little digging. And when we do some digging, then we can attach the ancient story. And we can attach the nature to the people. And we will clearly see what we're dealing with. And if we clearly see what we're dealing with, then we know exactly what to do with it. Okay? Now, if anybody disagrees with that, go ahead and raise your hand. But in the meantime, we're going to move forward with this broadcast and going into the other segments. And we got to come back to this ancient story and the religion and all of that to clearly get everything straight now, if you would, please. Got a little technical difficulties here. Okay, we have absolutely no sound. This is not good. So let's do something else here. Now, hold on 1 second. And we'll get that in there. Okay. We seem to have some technical difficulties here, Moores. And okay, we've just been reconnected, and I'm going to see how that is going to work out. And it appears that that ain't working too. This is amazing. I don't think these people want this kind of stuff out, boy. They fight me tooth and nail. I mean, if it ain't Facebook, it's Blog Talk. If it ain't Blog Talk, it's Twitter. If it ain't Twitter, is some of them I had to just really got over. You name it, all the way across the board is the most amazing set of circumstances that I've ever seen in my life for something like this to take place. But nevertheless, it is quite interesting. But the show must go on, no matter what. Okay, let's try this here then. See how that's going to work out. I just need y'all to hold on just for a second, and then we'll get out. No, that's not going to work. So let me go ahead and do this. Okay, here we go. All right, this ought to do it. I'm going to see. Wow. Never seen anything like this. This is quite amazing. But anyway, we only have a short while left. So what we're going to do here now is I'm going to open this thing back up this way. We'll do it this way. But if you pay attention to what I'm telling you, when you go and do an investigation on the words, look at the words that are being used. Like earlier, we had a gentleman that came in and he said that Europeans enslaved other Europeans, so therefore, Europeans don't owe people of African descent anything for slavery. And okay. He threw me for a loop with that one because I'm trying to figure out why you Europeans enslaved the Indians, or the people that you have labeled as Indian, which are no such thing, and the Japanese and the Chinese, and you give them the whole reparation. But because you enslave your people, you don't owe this particular people nothing. Help me out. With that one, if you could. That has been one of the most extraordinary things. I don't understand that one at all. No counterway, shape, form, or fashion. But nevertheless, he's written a whole book explaining it. Whoo, my goodness. I tell you, This is amazing. America is amazing to me. The things that I witness here. I had a gentleman that come to my house that told me that he was from the property appraiser's office, and his boss sent him here because he. I noticed that I had a sign over my garage, and my sign was too big. So I took him out in the streets. I said, could you come go with me and help me out? Because this is interesting, because I'm looking at a sign across the street in front of a Christian church that is three times larger than my sign. So I need you to help me go over here. Come go with me so we can tell them that we're going to have to take down our signs because it is too large. He didn't want to go with me. He said going downtown to talk to his boss because there was a mix-up. I had a very interesting situation that occurred once. Someone stole the gate off my fence. Now, the man next door, who was a Caucasian gentleman, he had dogs in his yard. Anybody come near either one of these houses, the dogs bark, 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 bark. But the night that the gate was stolen, the dogs were not barking. There wasn't a peep out of nobody. I woke up that morning, the gate was gone. I didn't hear no dogs. And I sleep light. So I called the police department. When the police department come in, they say, well, we're going to, you got any suspects that you think might do? I said, yeah. I said, I know who did it. I said, it was the white guy next door that did it. The first thing out the cop's mouth was, well, you know, Jesus said that certain people are not going to prosper. Blah, blah, blah. I said, well, you can say that. We ain't going to use none of that on him. He said, I beg your pardon? I said, I'm sorry, sir. Go on about your business. Well, no, I want to know what you said, we're going to do everything we can to get it back, but what did you say? I said, no, they'll say nothing. Just going on around the corner. I said, you don't have to worry about coming back. I said, we got it. We got it. We got it. We ain't going to need you no more. And that's very, very interesting. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm having a tremendous amount of problem getting back on the air. It seems that I have been completely blocked. This information has completely been blocked off the air, out the clear blue sky. This ain't the first time that it has happened. And this is something that I've never witnessed before, never experienced before. And the program has been paid for. So I'm going to call them and ask them to refund my money for the broadcast, because this is ridiculous. So we're going to go over here and see what we got. Now, I don't even have a switch. At all. Okay. Now, I can't even ask y'all to raise your hand. But to receive my free articles that I mentioned early in the broadcast, for those of you who are new and who are tuning in, I know by now we're probably lost. Okay.
Now, I can't even ask y'all to raise your hand. Receive my free articles that I mentioned.
I can hear myself.
For those of you who are new and who are tuning in, I know by now we're probably lost.
Wow, this is amazing. Okay, I'm going to have to ask them to refund my money for this. This is ridiculous. I think what I'll end up doing is probably suing them. I'll sue them. Look at this. Testing 1, 2, 3. Testing 1, 2, 3. I do not have a switchboard at all, and I'm out here in complete and total limbo. Cannot get in, cannot access anything. It's complete shutdown all the way across the board. No matter what I do, everything is blocked. I cannot see where I am. I cannot bring in the greatest show on earth. The next speaker was guaranteed to lay this whole thing out for you. And we're determined to get back in there so that we can lay it out. And so it can be heard nationwide. This is the destruction of credibility. And the truth is covered up, blocked and suppressed. Wow, amazing. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to call the company and gather some information a little soon. This isn't the first time that they have done this kind of thing. Right, I'm at it. And where it's coming from. Let's go. No. Can't go there. Let's go here. Run it. Okay, now we're back here. Let me see what I got here now. This has come up, and this is something that I don't need. What I need is access to the studio. Okay, all right. I'm back on the studio, and we're back now. Okay, let's try this one.
But the church is all over the place, and all of them have these white images. Everything is white. Nothing to indicate there was an African presence anywhere in the land. So I want to talk about that. I want to talk about, first, let's look at the land and try to get some kind of perspective on what Israel was like during the Bible time. Abraham, who is this Abraham? Where does it come from? Let's talk about it, and let's hold the land of Canaan and Palestine in perspective, if you can give us some overview and background.
I'm going to approach it in several different directions. One is, since it's the one we're most familiar with, the biblical direction. And in the book of Genesis, when it goes over the genealogies of human beings, according to the Israelite view, it says that Ham, who was noted as the ancestor of the Africans, and we're not going to deal with the curse of Ham here now, because that was not in the original Genesis record. We're just going to deal with Ham as a great ancestor, according to Hebrew tradition, that his sons were, he had four sons, and they were Cush, Mizraim, Punt, and Canaan. Now, Cush, we know, came to be known as Ethiopia. Cush, the Cushite Empire spread all over the world. But that was the Hebrew name for them. They probably had another name for the Nuba, was the proper name for the people. Nuba, because they came from Nubia. The Mizraim was the Israel Hebrew way of saying Kemet, or as the Greeks later called it, Egypt. And Punt was their way of saying Puanet, which was Somalia. And Canaan was that on the Palestinian strip. Now, interesting thing about Canaan is that Canaan is right there at the tip of the Fertile Crescent. Now, the heart and center of that Fertile Crescent is in the Nile. That was the richest producing soil in the world at that time. So why many people wanted that Palestinian strip of the land of Canaan is because of the wealth there at the tip of it. This biblical version lets you know that the Canaanites were in fact descendants of Ham, who everybody generally agrees were African people, Africoid people. The word Canaan itself is describing they're also called Phoenix, which describes a red, purple, or mahogany-colored people. That's what Canaan and Phoenix mean. The two words are synonymous. Now, this strip was very vital because whenever the Asian would attack Africa, they would have to cross Canaan to get to it. And whenever the African was going to repel the Asian or to stop the Asian in their tracks or to conquer Asian territory, they would go across that bridge. Now, the Hebrews who came in the days of Abraham, and I want to get this clear understanding, there was no Hebrew in the world before Abraham. Mm-hmm. And the proper term is Harabu, as Dr. Yusuf Bindochanan writes in African Origin of Major Western Religions. And it meant one who had crossed over the river. And that is because Abraham came from a place called Ur of Chaldea, which was the remnants of the ancient Sumerian Empire, the land of what they call the Blackheads, or the black-headed people. They were very black people. He came out of that land. Now, we assume that he was a black man, but even if he wasn't, his descendants spent over 430 years in Africa mating with Africans, and was only 77 of them under Jacob who went there, and they come out 3,160,000-some-odd strong in Egypt. Or what they misnomered Egypt, in Kemet, but what the Bible calls Egypt. So, but we can, I think, safely assume that Abraham was indeed a black man. He originated from Ur of Chaldea, not out of the sky, not of any place else. And also, just to put a footnote here, the oldest bones, the oldest remains dating about 50 to 70,000 years that have been found in Palestine, where Canaan was, in the Palestinian strip, are Africoid in all their features. From the osteological study, it shows dolichocephalia, the long-haired steatopygia, the big ample posterior. From the bones, we can tell all of that. The platyrrhinia, the broad nose, the thick lips, all of these are Africoid features. Mm-hmm. These are the oldest features in the land. At that time that Abraham was traveling out of Ur of Chaldea, the Europeans, or even the Eurasians, had not settled in any significant amount in the land. They had made incursions and attacks, but they had not settled. And one of the reasons why Abraham was leaving Ur of Chaldea was because the word was out that the Scythians were going to attack that land again, what is called Chaldea. They were going to attack that land. The Greeks called it Mesopotamia, the land between the two rivers, the Euphrates and the Tigris. Now, these Scythians were Indo-Europeans who, when they went to battle, they went buck-naked wearing a black cape. And the first person they felled in battle, they bit them in the neck and sucked the blood out of them to get their power and strength as a symbol of their conquest over that person. Now, they had attacked Chaldea 200 years earlier, and Abraham heard the devastation that they brought. So he knew that they were coming in, so he decided to leave. Now, in order for him to settle in Canaan, he had to go to the nation or the empire that had control over that land at the time, that was Kemet. So he had to go into Kemet and get permission from the officials, not the Pharaoh, because Abraham was not of a status that he could stand before the Pharaoh and speak to him. You had to be a world dignitary to do that, and he wasn't. He wasn't even a tribal leader yet. He didn't even have a good clan at present. He wasn't even a chieftain at this time. This was in the year approximately 1675 BCE. That's before the Common Era. This is the first Hebrew anywhere that comes, gets permission from the Kemetans, and he goes and begins to settle with his family in Canaan. Now, it's doubtful that he had over We would be generous to say he had 20 people in his family at the time. Mm-hmm. So that is the beginnings. Now, he has a son called Isaac, mm-hmm. and Isaac has a son, and he also has a son called Ishmael. He has Isaac by Zerah, who is from Ur of Chaldea, a black woman, probably, in all probability. We know that Hagar is a black woman from out of Kemet, because Kemet was predominantly black people. There was no more than 10% or 11% white population there at any time, and that was mostly during the days of the Greeks, and this is long before the Greeks come. And he had two sons by these two women, and Isaac had Jacob. And in the days of Jacob had 12 sons who became the patriarchs of the 12, what later became the 12 tribes of Israel. These are all black people we're talking about here now. Now, Jacob is living in Palestine at a time, according to the Genesis record, a famine strikes. And so he has to go to the place that has the most abundance of food. Everybody's flocking to that place at that time, and that's Africa, the continent of Africa, to Kemet. So he goes to Kemet and settles there. And his family, and it's only 70 to 77 of them when they go in. I want you to understand that. It's only 70 to 77 of them. In all probability, they were black people. We have no doubt about that. But even if they weren't, when they went in, only 70 to 77, and they come out, they stay there in the Nile Valley for 430 years, according to their records. Now, there's no record of them being enslaved. And had they been enslaved, had it been that many slaves there, they would have, because they came out over 3 million strong, had they been slaves, it would have been recorded, because the Kemetans recorded everything. Even if they hadn't recorded it, Persia would have recorded it, India would have recorded it, because they were recording everything in the world there. They were illiterate people. But they come out, the Bible says, the Exodus record says, that they come out 600,000 men, plus women and children. The average family consisted of 5 children at that time. They had a lot of children. Many of them had several wives. So we can safely estimate it's 3,100,000+ coming out there. They are essentially African, with an African religion, because their leader at the time is Moses. And Moses is described by Jethro's daughters as an Egyptian. They don't describe him as an Asian or anything. They describe him as an Egyptian. And the Egyptian was noted for...
Okay. Wow. Open up these lines before we go to the next plug. Area code 904. Tell us who you are, where you're calling from, which question or comment. 904. Hello? You're breaking up. Area code 323. You tell us who you are, where you're calling from, which question or comment. Area code 223.
Yeah, this is Nick calling out. Yeah, it's Nick calling out of Los Angeles. I just wanted to talk about when you said you got to pay attention to the words and study the words. First, I just want to say this first. I only know what I know or know what I've studied up to this point, so it's probably a lot that I don't know. Okay. This word black, man, this is crazy. You know, I got to know Webster's 1828. Now, from what I see in that definition, is that the word white is part of that definition. It also says the definition means pale, wine, silo, to make white, to lighten, bleach, bleak. You know, so from what I see, I mean, black people, according to that definition, is are the pale people. You know, but I just had a brother recently tell me that the word goes all the way back to Anglo-Saxon, and the Anglo-Saxons were originally the Saracens, that they were melanated people. So,
okay.
So. You know, and okay, I want to say this too. We said the brother said that the Europeans enslaved Europeans or whatever. From what I see, the Europeans were black. You know, so when I hear them say that they enslaved black people or black people were slaves, I do ask this question. Were they talking about melanated people?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because I read the book, right, A People's History of the United States, 1492 to present. This is a book by Howard Zinn. And in there, it seems as if the European came over here and basically, like, started a war with us, you know. And when you capture people in war, they're called prisoners of war, you know.
Uh-huh.
A lot of times prisoners of war are made to work. And in some cases, they're used to fight their own people. And they're indoctrinated into the winter's ways of life. Now, saying that, I don't think that they were necessarily slaves, you know. You may treat them as if they are a slave, but they're still prisoners of war by title,
mm-hmm.
you know. So even if you call them slaves, it don't mean that they were slaves. It means that they were prisoners of war that were made to work. Now, you may have your slaves by definition, which would more than likely be the black man, from what I see in the dictionary, is a pale person.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Okay, so now you're saying that dictionary that you have describes people that are dark-skinned as pale people, right?
Right, because dark, and I looked up the word dark. That also means nearly black or black. You know, I have a picture of it on my Facebook. Let me go. I'm gonna go on and post a link to the picture, and you know that reads out the definition. You know,
all right. Well, let me tell you what I found out. This is what I found out
mm-hmm.
when I went back to the earliest definitions in Webster's. It clearly says it white and describes it as clear and pure and all of this stuff. But what I start noticing as I move forward from there up into the 20th, earlier ages on up into the early centuries where we are now, I found that what they began to do is to remove that definition and begin to attribute and install the word white and attach it to the Caucasian.
Right.
So what we have is because if you have a red bird, you look at that red bird, you see that red bird, and you say, well, okay, that red bird is clearly a cardinal, and cardinals have specific behavioral patterns. They have an ancient history, goes all the way back to the gods that named them as cardinals. But what we're going to do, we're going to now officially call them crows. We're no longer going to refer to them as cardinals. We're going to call them crows. And if we call them crows, crows have a whole different nature. That means that no matter what the cardinal does, he's not a cardinal, he's a crow, because he's been detached. We done removed all the God out of it. We done distorted any behavior away from it, took it away out there, and we're going to make sure that, because we already know that in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God, and the Word was with God. So that's the first line of defense. We're going to attack the Word, mislabel it to take the God out of it and distort and cover up his ancient story and attribute something else, so which automatically causes confusion. So we say you are black, instead of saying that you are an ancient Canaanite or an ancient Moabite, which is attached to a story and a particular behavioral pattern, then we have distorted, we have covered up, and we have detached you from your true nature. Brother, the time is fleeting. I'm happy to get on. Appreciate you calling in.
Very true. Very true.
All right, going back to area code 904, one more time. 904, you got that line straight now? Come on in. 904. We still have gobble transmission. Still got gobble transmission. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, let's go ahead and continue.
They're dark color and they're apricoid features. And this is happening around 1200. This is about 400 years after Abraham has been there, almost 500 years. This is happening around 1200 BCE. And Herodotus, the Greek historian, not the father of history, one of the first Europeans to record history, but not the father of history, he says in his day, which was around 450 BCE, that the Kemetans, or the Egyptians as they called them, were jet black people, just like the Ethiopians and the Chaldeans. So they were now, 800 years later, still jet black people. So in Moses, when the Jethro's daughter see him, they describe him as a black man. Also in the biblical story, it says when Moses is receiving his call at the burning bush, and he is reluctant to accept the call, then he is told to put his hand in his bosom, and when his hand comes out, it's white as snow, and it frightens him. Then when he agrees to answer the call, he's told to put his hand back in his bosom, and it's back like it was before. Now, if it was white when he pulled it out and it turned back to its original color, that should tell us, give us some indication, that the man was not a white man. That he was obviously a black man, as was most all of the Israelites at that time were black people. Now, as time went on, there were constant invasions from the north in Israel, as there was in Kemet and in India and Arabia and other places, where the lighter races began to dominate the north and drive the darker races further south. So there was this admixture going on, this miscegenation by force of a conquering force. However, the Hebrews were generally reluctant to mate with people outside of themselves, even other black people, often outside of themselves, their tradition and their religion. Their prophets were very strict about that. Now, it isn't until the days of the Greeks that we get this very light population beginning to come in, but they're not dominant. And the Greeks come in about 300 BCE, and then, of course, the Romans follow them in 30 BCE. And that's when you start getting a light-skinned population, but still they're predominantly dark-skinned people. Now, when Jesus appears on the scene, he is of the tribe of Judah. And of the 12 tribes of the children of Israel, Judah is the navy blue-black tribe. Now, how do we know that? When you go back in the book of Genesis, you find that they are mixed with Hittite, Jebusite, all kind of ites. And Dr. Justice taught us in the seminary all those ites were black because all of those ites came from Ham and came from Canaan. And Canaan was the son of Ham, and the ites were the grandson of Ham. So the according to even the biblical record, these are obviously Africoid peoples. Now, the Jesus, a tribe of Judah, maintains more of its color. Some of the other tribes are a little mixed, like we are today, from chalk to charcoal, as a result of invaders. But the tribe of Judah produced the kings. And in order for you to become a Christ or an anointed one, you had to come out of that tribe, and that tribe had to maintain more closely than any other tribe its genetic physical features. The very word Christ itself is from the Indian word Krishna, as Joel A. Rogers tells us, which means the black one, the anointed one. To be anointed as a Messiah, you had to be kissed of the Son. You had to be a child of the Son. This was tradition throughout the whole ancient world. Mm-hmm. So here Jesus comes now, born of the tribe of Judah, and obviously a very black man when you trace his lineage. When you look at the two birth certificates of Jesus, and his proper name is Yeshua, because there was nobody named Jesus. That's not a Hebrew word. Yeshua, meaning God will deliver us, or our liberator. The same as in the Old Testament, they call it Joshua. When you look at the two birth certificates, one in Matthew and one in Luke, and you trace his lineage, you find all these Africans in there. You find all these Hamites, as they call it, the quote-unquote, use white folks' term, Hamitic tribes, because there was no difference between the Shemites and the Hamites. They were of the same racial stock. In fact, the Bible says very clearly in Amos, the 9th chapter and the 7th verse, it says, "Are ye not as the children of Egypt and Ethiopia unto me, O Israel?" Which was bespeaking the fact that they were the same racial stock. Now, another reason we know that Jesus was a black man is that the most ancient, the oldest icons of Jesus shows him as an African. And probably the most noted one is in the British Museum, and there are many, of the coin minted by Justinian II in the 8th century of the Common Era, or what is sometimes called the Christian Era. In the 8th century, by Justinian II, Emperor Justinian II of the Roman Empire. And what it has on one side of the coin is a man with obvious Africoid features, kanky hair, kind of corn-rolled looking hair, broad nose, thick lips. And it has in Latin, "Our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ." On the obverse side of the coin is an alpine looking person with the straight hair of the European and Europoid features. And it says Emperor Justinian II. So you can clearly distinguish who is who. This is in the British Museum even unto this day. Joel A. Rogers has printed it in his books. Dr. Ivan Van Sertima in his Journals of African Civilization has printed it. And it's been shown in many other works, scholarly works. Now, getting back now, when the Romans come, going back in time now, when the Romans come in 30 CE, or BCE, I'm sorry, before the Common Era, and take power from the Kemetans in the days of Cleopatra the VII, they also take Palestine and they take Syria and several other nations in that area. Mm-hmm. This white nation, this European nation now, begins to dominate the indigenous people in Palestine and in that part of Africa known as Egypt, there in the Nile Valley. When they do this, there is constant resistance, especially on the part of the Israelites. They're constantly involved in warfare to fight against them. And there were always these messiahs rising up that the Romans had to deal with. So what you have essentially is a white power, European power, dominating a black nation on its own land. And this power had as its symbol the eagle. It also had as its governing body the Senate. The same as you have in the United States of America today, which is merely an extension of the Roman Empire. Now, they were oppressing these people on their own land. And the day that Jesus ben Joseph was born, or Yeshua ben Joseph, the one we know the most, because there were so many men named Yeshua at that time. And the day that he was born, he became one in a great line of messiahs whose purpose was to prepare his people to be delivered, primary purpose, from the Romans. Now, often in Christian theology and mythology, they have you thinking that Jesus was totally detached from the political activity going on in the land. That would have been impossible for him to do and get the attention of the masses, because the masses' primarily concern was to get liberation from the Romans. His very name bespoke that. Thou shalt call his name Jesus or Yeshua, because he shall save his people from their sins. Which meant we think they're talking about saving them from committing adultery or something like that. It's talking about the word sin as used in the New Testament and used in the English language today comes from the word which means imbalance. And when one is being enslaved by another, especially in their homeland, that is an imbalance. So they would be saved from their imbalance. That is what they were looking for. They weren't looking for any other type of deliverer, and he couldn't have gotten the masses out had he been talking about anything other than that. When the Romans crucified him, they didn't crucify him for teaching nonviolence. They did not crucify him for starting a new religion. The Romans couldn't have cared less about somebody starting a new religion, because they had so many in the empire already, it didn't make any difference. One new one didn't make another god. That's all it was. What they were concerned about was he stirred up the people. That was a charge brought against him, even in the New Testament. And what they arrested him for and what they crucified him for was daring to call himself a king, the king of Israel, which was political office. And the Romans said that the only king that could exist in Israel as long as they had power in that land, as they were dominant in that land, was someone whom they had appointed. And therefore, they crucified or assassinated him on the cross for that reason. No other reason.
Okay, let's try it one more time. Area code 904.
Hello?
Okay, I hear you now.
Oh, hey.
What's on your mind, sister? Sharon?
Oh, I was just listening to the show. I was calling in when you was having all those difficulties with the station, and I see you got it back up. I thought maybe if I just logged in, I might jerk it into working right or something. I don't know.
Well, I hope that is. It seemed like you breaking up on that end. But first thing in the morning, I'm going to find out exactly where they are, get all the information on them, and I'll send them an affidavit because this is damaging. This isn't the last time I've recorded all the information that I need. We got witnesses that agree to testify before a grand jury on the theft. But anyway, you got a question or comment?
No, I was just listening and enjoying the show.
All right. Well, I certainly appreciate you calling in. I'm going on to the next plug because I'm running out of time. They stole my time. All right. Let's roll.
It continued to be a strong force against invaders of Africa for a good while. Even after the Romans took it over, it was a strong force against invading Arabized Muslims for a long time, as Dr. Chancellor Williams points out in The Destruction of Black Civilization. Now, I'm running a little ahead of myself here. Well, Constantine then becomes converted, and he says this. He says, I want all of you bishops of these various churches to meet with me at the Council of Nicaea, which is now in Turkey, in the year 325 of the Common Era. Because at that time, Christians were going into the arenas, the very arenas that the Roman Imperial Rome had used to feed them to the lions and to crucify them and burn them at the stake, and they were going in slaying each other over which gospel was the right gospel and which gospel wasn't and which form of Christianity was the right one and which was. I mean, there was a lot of splinter groups going on, and they were fighting each other. Constantine said, we have to have one codified system of belief. So he called these bishops together, African bishops included. It was at this time that the African church lost control. The African bishops who went to the Council of Nicaea, at the head of that group was Arius. And at the Council of Nicaea, the European bishops, 310 of them, said, this is what we're going to believe, and this is what we believe, that Jesus was born of a woman without the aid of a man. Now, that was not even imagined before this time. That he is not only the Son of God, but he is one and the same essence with God, therefore is God. He did not have a wife and children, which was utterly, utterly insane. Because every record, every other gospel said that he had wife and children. Some said he may have had two wives. Because you have four gospels in the New Testament now, but you had at least 70 in circulation at that time. Gospel meaning good news, and was another term for biography on the life of Jesus, is what it was. Now, they took the four gospels they could best edit and bend to the system of belief and doctrines they wanted Christianity, Eurocentric, let me be very clear on that, Christianity to adapt. Arius and the African bishops from Carthage and from Alexandria and from Ethiopia, they said, no. This is not true, what you're saying. And the European bishop said it's true if we want it to be true, and we have the army of Constantine to back it up. And if you don't agree with it, get out. So they ran Arius and the Africans out of the council. They had to go up in the mountains to find refuge to keep from being killed. And they led their struggle from there, which somehow spread up into Germany. Aryanism went all the way up into Germany somehow, and was a constant struggle with European Christianity. It was then that the Roman Church took over, and that the power began to be transferred from Imperial Rome to Papal Rome. Still, Palestine is of no significance. This thing they call the Holy Land is still of no significance. It's concentrated, the church was concentrated in Africa, now it's being concentrated in Rome. A political movement started by an African in Palestine is now taking over, and its headquarters is in Rome.
Where was the headquarters in Africa?
It was in Jerusalem. Oh, and in Africa, it was in Alexandria. The church in Alexandria, and I'm trying to think of the one in Ethiopia, the oldest one there, the Coptic church, and I cannot think of the city. Aksum, that's right. The city of Aksum, the oldest there, and Qarqara, what they call Carthage. Those were the centers of Christianity at that time. Because Jerusalem was gone, man. So this was the center. When the Romans took it over, the African church almost essentially kind of cut itself off. And it didn't even look to Rome anymore until they were attacked by the Arabs. That's when they asked the Romans to come help them. Now, it continues to grow in Rome, but it doesn't have the power and force in Europe it wants to, because the rest of the tribes in Europe, because at that time there was no England, there was no France, there was no Germany, it was Gauls, Britons, they were tribes. They didn't have any nations then. And they had been controlled by the Roman Empire for a long time. In fact, one of the greatest emperors who brought peace to the wild Britons for over a century was Septimius Severus. In 198 CE. And he died, as a matter of fact, in Britain from the cold up there. He was an African emperor of Rome who refused to eat Roman food. He had his food imported from Africa because they had to have the spice of it. And he spoke Latin with an African accent. And he was African in culture and went back to Kemet into Egypt to visit there so he could learn about his ancestors, and had the bones of Rome's worst enemy dug up and buried in a marble and gold sepulcher in the center of Rome itself, the bones of Hannibal, of Carthage. This is the audacity this black man had. But he was such a great general. He controlled the army, and whoever controlled the army in Rome at that time was the emperor. Well, that he died about 211, I believe. And then now we get back to Constantine, which is 325. We come back up to that. After Constantine, several other emperors come along. The empire had fallen apart. You had the Byzantine Empire in the east, and you had the Western Roman Empire, which was much of nothing. It was in the year 538 CE that the Roman army, directed by the Pope of Rome now, not by the Emperor, the Western Roman army directed by the Pope of Rome, finally felled the last Arian resistance in Europe. And that was when they took the power from Clovis, who was a Gaul, and that made the Roman Catholic Church the dominant power in all of Europe at that time. Now, mind you, this church, which was supposed to be walking in the shoes of the fishermen, did not come into power with prayer. The Holy Ghost didn't bring it into power. It came into power with the sword. When Constantine said to them, whatever you decide, I'm going back to 325 now, I know I keep jumping back and forth. He said, whatever you decide, that will be the doctrine of Christianity. And I will back it up with the army. So, consequently, what we believe about Christianity today was not brought about by Jesus, was not brought about by the apostles, was not brought about by God. It was brought about by the army of Constantine and perpetuated by the Roman armies in support of the Pope once he took power completely. Now, a new power came on the scene that had to be reckoned with. A new star arose in the east. A black man with frizzly hair, jet black man, as Jolie Rogers tells us, born to the Quraysh tribe in Arabia, became a prophet of a new religion called Islam. And one of the main people in Islam, as the prophet Muhammad ibn Abdullah said, whose father was al-Matalib, his grandfather, a jet black man. The third part of Islam was Bilal ibn Hazrat ibn Rahab, was his name, Bilal, who was a servant at first to the Prophet Muhammad, and then became an equal partner. It was Bilal who developed most of, and a lot of Muslims don't like to admit this, the theology of Islam, the theology of paradise. You get the 70 black virgins if you die in jihad. If you're brave, you go straight to paradise. You get 70 black virgins, perfume virgins, who are all yours. The tree of, what's that, the divine tree of life, which stretched, I think, 150 miles or something like that. All of this mythology that came in paradise. It was Bilal. Bilal brought the azan, the calling of the azan, the call to prayer and all that. Now, there is some question as to whether the Prophet Muhammad was a literate man or not. There is question to that. Now, there are many Muslims that will argue you down, but there is a question about that. But getting back to it, this new force rising was a refreshing force. Many of the Jews embraced it because the Eurocentric Christians had been oppressing them. But this force now began to, it started out good, like most religions do, but once it became a religion of the state, it became an orthodoxy. And when it becomes an orthodoxy, it means you can only believe what has been defined and accepted by that organized religion, and anything beyond that is not tolerated. That means your mind cannot go beyond that. It puts a ceiling, a cap on your intellect and your intellectual growth. The Christians had done that. The Roman Christians had done that with orthodoxy, but they were burning people at the stake for being heretics. The Muslims now began to do this after the death of Muhammad, the prophet, and it became a state religion eventually. Their thing was conquest, and they went to spread Islam not with prayer but with the sword, just like Christianity was spreading with the sword. And they attacked the African Christians next door to them at Aksum, and then they went on and attacked in Egypt, and they went on to attack in other places. And these Africans, in trying to fight off these Arab attackers, began to call upon the Byzantine emperor to help them, saying, "We are Christian brothers after all." Prior to this time, the Africans had paid very little attention to the European Christians. They said, "We need your armies to help us, so let's fight these off." This struggle goes on for several centuries. It is in 1096 that Urbane I, Pope Urbane I of the Roman Catholic Church, is invited by the Byzantine emperor to come help them fight the Muslims, because the Muslims are kicking everybody.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to have to stop right here. We've lost some time. I did my best to bring it to you in its entirety, but we're going to deal with that tomorrow. We're coming back with part two of this because there's a tremendous amount of information that we're going to have to add to this. I've been your host, Tohaka Monreal Bay, and until next time, you all have a good evening, okay?
World gone mad. Some of us can't find our way. No. If I had my way, I'd change it fast. There would be good times every day. Well, I've been thinking, but
but it's all I got. I got so much love inside, oh yes I do. There are some things man could never stop. Changing is a brand new day. Please don't.